Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
If you have kids, you know it's hard to get them to eat right. Heck, it's hard for adults to eat fresh fruits and vegetables with every meal.
I love burgers and fries, yeah, and I love ice cream and cake, and so do most kids. And we're not talking about a lifestyle that excludes all that. The question is, how do we help people balance that out?
Maybe what the First Lady needs is a chorus of singing vegetables straight out of the Muppet Show.
And now, presenting my singing food!
We have an old-fashioned tomato.
Between overhauling healthcare and getting kids to eat broccoli, I kind of think the first task is the easier one.
Oh, I love my vegetables! How are you, cabbage?
Oh, getting ahead.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 9th, and the takeaway for me, John, is, you know, he thinks it's hard to tangle with the Republicans over health care. Wait till he tries to separate kids from their Lucky Charms.
Well, I think you're right. Vegetables do need a powerful lobbying organization, and the Muppets are definitely it there. I think that's some serious sway. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. After talking about it for days, it's official. Toyota is recalling over 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. Toyota President Akio Toyoda says the company is committed to fixing the braking systems on models that went on sale last year.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
More than 130,000 customers, Prius hybrids, and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids are part of today's U.S. recall. And if you're counting, that means Toyota's recall is now close to 9 million vehicles worldwide.
Tributes are being paid this morning to John Murtha, the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in Congress. He died yesterday following complications from gallbladder surgery. Murtha was 77 years old. He represented a district in southwestern Pennsylvania known for its steel mills and coal mines. He wielded considerable clout for two decades as the ranking Democrat on the committee that oversees Pentagon spending. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell says it's a big loss for the state.
He was our go-to guy, someone that whatever the issue was, could weigh in and make things happen for us.
Murtha spent 36 years in Congress.
Iran is saying that it has begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, far short of the weapons grade 90% needed for nuclear bombs, but still increases fears, and Western nations are calling for sanctions.
And just last hour, First Lady Michelle Obama launched a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. She tells ABC News it'll encourage more physical activity for kids, healthier foods in schools, and more accurate food labeling.
This is going to require an effort on everyone's part.
You can say that again. We're joined now by Tony Gerasi. He's the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. Tony, good morning.
Good morning.
How many kids do you serve every day?
83,000 plus hungry kids.
Okay, so, I mean, cafeteria food, not knowing for being all that delicious. So what's the best healthy entree you serve to kids?
Well, it's going to come off of our Meatless Monday menus. We do a baked lasagna served with like a romaine lettuce salad and fresh fruit, or the baked eggplant parmesan also served with like steamed vegetables and fresh fruit.
It sounds good to me. I don't know if it would sound good to my 11-year-old. We're going to talk more to Joni Gerasi in just a moment. But we're asking you to weigh in on this. If you've ever gone on a diet, you know it's pretty hard. We want to get your personal take. What are your tips for losing weight?
This is Megan from Massachusetts. I lost some weight, and the way I did it was I made small, healthy choices, and I never really sacrificed anything. If I wanted it, I had it. But I'd wait. If I wanted pizza, wait 2 days and then eat it.
Give us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or post on our website, thetakeaway.org. Looking at the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 9,908. The S&P opens at 1,056 and the NASDAQ at 2,126.
In honor of upcoming Valentine's Day, love in the workplace. Beth Koblenner's on the case. And more on Michelle Obama and childhood obesity in just a few minutes.
Okay, we all know Americans are fat. Two-thirds of U.S. adults and nearly one in three children are overweight or obese, increasing the risk for diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic illnesses. So the White House is now taking on junk food. Today, the First Lady unveils Let's Move, an administration-wide campaign to fight childhood obesity. Here's Michelle Obama on Good Morning America just about an hour ago.
We want to improve the quality of food in our schools, and we want to make food more affordable and accessible because we have food deserts for more than 23.5 million Americans, folks who don't live anywhere near a supermarket, so they can't get access to good, fresh produce.
Joining us now, the Arkansas Surgeon General and practicing pediatrician Joe Thompson. He's the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center to Prevent Childhood Obesity. And Tony Geraci is the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. He's trying to introduce some better eating habits on a very tight budget. Welcome to both of you. And good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
And Tony Geraci joins us again. He's the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Thompson, we've been hearing these reports for years. It hasn't seemed to alarm anyone over much, parents anyway, and we haven't seen childhood obesity reducing, going down, I should say. And yet you have some amazing statistics, and you've actually have reports from people who are saying that childhood obesity is a threat to our national security. What makes this such an important issue?
Well, I think this decade we have recognized how much our children have gained weight over the last three decades, and we're starting now to see the impact of adult diseases in earlier and earlier ages. It really represents a threat not only to the future well-being of our families and communities, but also of our workforce, and that's why it has become such a critical issue.
Well, there's there's a number of different causes for why a child could be overweight. I mean, it could be a huge number of things, but it's most likely not genetics.
That's absolutely correct. We've seen this epidemic blossom over the last three decades, and your genes don't change that quickly. It really is basically because our kids are eating far more calories than they need, and they're not burning off as many by being physically active.
Tony Geraci, you serve, as you said, 85,000 students or so per day in the Baltimore City Schools?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's more than 200 schools that you cater to.
Correct.
So you bring these kids in. I'm sure a lot of them aren't happy that they're eating in the cafeteria anyway. How do you get them to eat something healthy? I mean, how do you get 85,000 kids to eat eggplant parmesan?
Well, look, the population that I serve are largely underprivileged, and the meals that they get at school are probably the only real meals that they're going to get every day that are consistent. So what we try to do is we try to offer up better choices for our kids. One in three kids born after the year 2000 are going to get type 2 diabetes, and one in two African-American kids are going to get this disease. And the good doctor is right. This is going to devastate our country in the next 20 years.
Dr. Thompson, you come from Arkansas. Arkansas, I think, is number two on the states that are most overweight. How have you dealt with this in your own state as Surgeon General there?
Well, I think we, like other southern states, and as your other guest mentioned, lower-income communities have an extra added risk from the obesity. We've really taken an approach to try to change the environment that kids live, learn, and play every day, trying to improve the cafeteria offerings in the school, trying to increase the level of activities both within the school and changing the environment around the school so that kids can walk and bike again. And we're raising awareness so that parents actually recognize the risk and can take some simple steps that over time will make a lasting change.
Okay, but parents themselves have trouble losing weight, and I imagine they would then have trouble getting their kids to. And, you know, you also, Mike Huckabee, quite famously tried to, as a politician, set an example, as a politician set policy that would help change people's healthy eating habits, and that didn't exactly work. How do you do that as a policymaker?
Well, I think it will take the actions of all policymakers. We have continued many of the programs and are trying to expand those now under a Democratic governor, and we're seeing a halting of the obesity epidemic. But we've got to have change at the federal and the local levels working in concert if we're going to be able to reverse this epidemic.
So, Tony Geraci, do you have kids?
Yeah, I have three kids, in fact.
Okay, so if you, as you said, if these kids are coming to school and it's one of their only meals, that's not a solution for their entire eating habits. What do you think is your one piece of advice in order for parents to deal with childhood obesity?
Well, I think to try to get better choices in front of their kids. Our kids today live in this world of portion distortion. They've been supersized for so many years and so many generations now that kids don't even understand what a real portion is. I had a group of high school kids in my office a couple of weeks ago talking about wanting more food I think education is the key. I think we've got to sit down and start having real conversations about food.
Okay, Dr. Thompson, what's the one piece of advice you could maybe give to First Lady Michelle Obama that would actually work?
Well, I would ask her and more importantly, everyone across the nation to really challenge to become much more aware of your environment. I mean, employers need to look at what's in the vending machines, the opportunity for us to see where grocery stores are not so that families could actually have access to healthier foods. These are all things that we can take on with policy change to make the healthy choice become the easy choice.
Well, it's not exactly easy to change an entire family's eating habits. And Tony Geraci, if you're handling the kids because they're a captive audience in your cafeteria, do you ever reach out to parents and try to change what they're doing at home?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of parent engagement, and we're working with parents now around healthier choices and trying to create opportunity for fresh food in neighborhoods that, quite honestly, are food deserts.
And the answer to those who say it's too expensive to eat healthily, Tony Geraci actually serves meals for about $2.75 per kid, so I guess it is affordable. Tony Geraci, food service director for the Baltimore City Schools. He serves about 85,000 kids every day. And Dr. Joseph Thompson is Surgeon General for Arkansas and founder of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center to Prevent Childhood Obesity. And we're asking you today, in this push to get Americans to eat more healthily, especially our kids, what are your tips for eating right and losing weight? Or what are your personal vices? Do you have something which is just causes you to eat badly every single time you see it? Maybe
our
listener
curator Leo wants you to confess your vices. He that's his thing. Okay, if you don't want to confess your vices,
8778 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. And now let's check in on the top stories at 15 minutes after the hour.
Toyota says it will recall more than 130,000 Prius cars and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids in the U.S., part of a worldwide recall to fix brake problems. Toyota's president says his company is, quote, not an infallible company that never makes mistakes. Iran says it has begun a new program of enriching its uranium to a higher grade of 20%. That's far below weapons grade. Project began despite objections from the international community. And yesterday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the United Nations should impose sanctions on Iran in, quote, weeks, not months.
In Connecticut, authorities have opened a criminal investigation into the cause of an explosion at a power plant on Sunday. Middletown Police Chief Patrick McMahon says officials have a warrant to investigate the site.
Although intentional criminal acts have been ruled out, we have not ruled out criminal acts of negligence. And therefore, until that search warrant has expired, it is a crime scene and is treated as such.
The explosion killed 5 people. Weather news now. Just as the Mid-Atlantic region digs out from the blizzard over the weekend, the area is expecting another big storm. The nation's capital may be in for another foot of snow or more. And finally, for fans in New Orleans, the Super Bowl victory party continues today as the Saints are honored with a parade this afternoon, beginning at their home turf, the Louisiana Superdome. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're looking ahead all this week to the 2010 Winter Olympics.
I'm hoping that people feel like they're part of the skating world again, and we haven't had that in the United States since Nancy and Tanya.
Well, the answer to Nancy and Tanya, Johnny Weir, and complete with swan skating costumes. We're going to have a profile of him in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout this morning is an obituary and also a discussion of a coming changing of the guard in the Congress, the House, and the Senate. Congressman John P. Murtha from the 12th District of Pennsylvania died yesterday at the age of 77 after suffering complications from gallbladder surgery. He made headlines shortly after the onset of the Iraq War, really in the mid-2000s, when he called for the war to end, that the future of our country cannot sustain the Iraq War, and he spoke publicly about it.
Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America.
John Murtha, who died in complications from a gallbladder surgery yesterday. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has covered Congressman Murtha for all the time you've been on Capitol Hill. Here was somebody from the Vietnam generation who had a long rise and then a difficult sort of end game.
Yeah, that's right, John. Jack Murtha, a 19-term congressman and former Marine colonel. And one of the old guard of the Vietnam era, as you mentioned. There are still plenty of Vietnam vets left in Congress, but Murtha was one of the most influential. I want to paint a picture for you quickly of the House chamber, just to give you a sense of how Murtha operated. He was famous for it around Congress. There's no assigned seating in the House of Representatives. Members sit wherever they want. But in the back corner, in the back row on the right-hand side, there's a little area that's informally known as the Pennsylvania Corner. Huh. And that's where members from Pennsylvania go to chat. It's just an informal place. And this area is known because Jack Murtha was always found there. If you wanted to find Jack Murtha during any given vote, you look in the back row in the corner, and there was Murtha holding court. Members gathered around him, sometimes passing notes, coming for advice, coming for discussions from both sides of the aisle. And they did it for a couple of reasons. One, 19 terms. The guy knew where the bones were buried. He was a very senior member. But also, as a senior appropriator, he controlled all of the spending at the Defense Department, not to mention all those thousands and thousands of earmarks. And that's how Jack Murtha did business. He controlled so much of the pet money that members needed to bring back to those bases in their districts. And they came to see Murtha because, as everyone knew in Congress, Jack Murtha gaveth and Jack Murtha tooketh away. Everyone knew it, and that's why they came to see him in the Pennsylvania corner.
But ironically, it was Murtha's proximity to that Pentagon largesse that was in some sense his undoing. He could have been majority leader, but it didn't make it.
He came very close. When Nancy Pelosi reached the speakership after being House Minority Leader for so many years, she backed Jack Murtha to be Majority Leader. He lost. And you're right, John. Part of the reason he did was his proximity to earmarking some scandals that have affected a lot of lobbying firms. Now, we have to stress that Jack Murtha was never convicted of any crimes or even charged. I got to take you back to the Belushi era of Saturday Night Live, almost 1980, the abscam, FBI sting, where several members of Congress took bribe money from who they thought was a corrupt Arab sheik, a Saudi sheik. Turns out it was an FBI informant in a beard. Jack Murtha never took a bribe, but he was in the room, and he was never charged, but he was implicated.
You know, it occurred to me yesterday that this Vietnam generation in the House and the Senate, it has an interesting legacy. I mean, you've got Murtha, you've got Kerry, a combat veteran. John Kerry, Bob Kerry, combat veteran. Right. You got John McCain, combat veteran. But both Kerry and McCain also ran for the president. Ironically, the draft dodgers, Clinton and George W. Bush, who was in the National Guard, got it to the White House. The combat veterans didn't make it. Cheney got 5 deferments and made it to be one of the most powerful vice presidents in U.S. history. What is the legacy here?
Well, look at Randy Duke Cunningham, a famous Vietnam ace pilot, powerful member of Congress who went to jail for corruption just a couple of years ago. It's an interesting way to look at it, John. Jack Murtha, again, a Marine colonel. He was the first Vietnam veteran elected to Congress, and some of the Iraq veterans and newer veterans who are getting elected now look to him as a mentor, people like Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania, who is an Iraq veteran. You're right that a lot of the combat veterans never made it to the very top. Murtha himself, as you said, almost reached majority leader, but not quite, but he wielded enormous power in the House. He wielded the kind of power you don't see, the behind-the-scenes money power.
And McCain still does, we should say. Todd Zwillick, a Takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about a coming changing of the guard there with the passing of John Murtha.
And now to our sports takeout with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. The Super Bowl is over and we're moving on to the 2010 Olympic Games. And we have a profile today of someone who, if nothing else, he sparks a discussion around his sport. That's figure skater Johnny Weir. Ibrahim, Johnny Weir is known for his outlandish costumes. Not only that, but what he says, he's kind of outspoken in what he says. That's how he's become sort of a focus of media attention.
Well, just to get a sense of who Johnny Weir is, he's the ultimate commenter on the ice and in defending his sport. Listen to what he had to say to ESPN's Jim Capel.
That's why people don't necessarily think it's a real sport, is because it looks easy. We're not out there tackling or being tackled or checked or running excessively. It looks effortless and beautiful and graceful and all these things, but you know, I would challenge any football player or baseball player, well, especially baseball players. I mean, how you can be 300 pounds and play a sport and get paid millions of dollars to do it, I'll never know.
So Johnny Weir is a three-time national champion, and he's a former world bronze medalist, but he hasn't won gold at the Olympics, and that's what this Olympics is about for Johnny Weir, to prove that.
Well, he missed his bus, famously, didn't he? When he was supposed to skate, he went out to go catch the bus, and the bus schedule had changed, and he didn't know it, and he didn't make it on time.
And for those moments, he gets an incredible amount of attention. In 2007, the movie Blades of Glory was built around his life.
That's right.
He's got a show on the Sundance.
Not flattering.
Yeah. And he's got a show on the Sundance Channel, but I think what's important about him is that he challenges the gender binary. He kind of pushes the boundaries. You don't really know which way he's coming from, but you have to acknowledge that he's an incredibly gifted athlete.
At the
age of 12, he did an axel on his first week on skates, and his coach is like, "How did you learn how to do that?" And he said, "I just watched it on TV." So if anything about Johnny Weir is that he is incredibly gifted, and he is definitely a person to watch.
And he is a fierce competitor,
indeed,
as you said. Thanks so much, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway sports contributor. Coming up, we're going to be talking about what the president wants to do to get some agreement on health care.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, new strategy and tactics by the Obama administration on health care reform. We'll talk with David Herzenhorn of The New York Times in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Bad news continues for Toyota, but they just made it official this morning. The company recalling 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids sold here in the United States last year. It's part of the latest recall of over 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. Toyota President Akio Toyoda says he may come to the U.S. next week to explain the massive recalls, which cover nearly 9 million cars total.
Let me assure everyone that we will redouble our commitment to quality as a lifeline of our company, with myself taking the lead.
He'll be dealing with economic ripples from all the recalls. This morning, the Washington Post reports that State Farm, the nation's largest auto insurer, warned federal regulators about problems with Toyotas as far back as 2007. Iran says it's begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, far short of the weapons grade 90%. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates says it wants the UN Security Council to approve a resolution in weeks, not months, that would impose new sanctions against Iran.
If Iran continues and develops nuclear weapons, it almost certainly will provoke nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. This is a huge danger.
China, though, remains opposed to sanctions, and they do have veto power. In Afghanistan, there are reports that the Taliban is preventing people from fleeing a city that's the target of a NATO offensive. Witnesses in Marja say families are huddling inside their homes to avoid being caught in the crossfire. A quick check of the markets. The Dow will start at 9,908, and the S&P opens at 1,056, the NASDAQ at 2,126. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So the future of health care reform on Capitol Hill, well, the president has a plan. And on the one hand, it sounds completely reasonable, inviting congressional leaders from both parties to the White House to get people together to attempt to find some sort of common ground. Here he is speaking about what his intentions are, talking to the Democratic National Committee fundraiser in Washington last Thursday.
What I'd like to do is have a meeting whereby I'm sitting with the Republicans, sitting with the Democrats, sitting with health care experts. And let's just go through these bills, their ideas, our ideas. Let's walk through them in a methodical way so that the American people can see and compare what makes the most sense.
We do have a name for that. It's called Congress and the White House. That's what they're supposed to be doing. But, of course, the failures on health care reform motivated the president to do something with cameras rolling. Is it a high-stakes game, or is it utterly reasonable and really the only way to move forward on health care reform right now? We've asked David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, to join us. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Haven't talked to you for a while. You know, this seems to me to be both kind of standard issue Obama, but also certainly a departure from relying on Congress to actually deliver a bill. Which is it?
Well, look, you know, right now they don't have the votes in Congress. So if you want to pass a bill, you better do something. And the president is trying to send messages to a lot of folks, to lawmakers, to voters, that he's not giving up on this. And yet, as you point out, you know, there's one place where the debate matters, and that's on the floor of each chamber in
Congress, and in the Senate, the Democrats have a problem. They can't get past a Republican filibuster.
Now, let me push back a little bit on this, and you can throw water all over me if you like. What is the chance that this will actually produce a compromise bill versus just making a lot of campaign videos for Republicans who will be seen standing up to the president who's trying to force something down the Americans' throats?
Well, you know, look, this could go both ways, right? I mean, the president might be creating a situation where he offers some political cover to Democrats to do what they need to do to move, you know, a bill in expedited fashion through the Senate under a budget reconciliation process that would need only 51 votes. Remember, 51 votes is still a majority of the Senate as opposed to the filibuster, which takes 40 votes to stop it. So, you know, both sides are jockeying for position here. The chance of a bipartisan compromise bill, there seems to be very little of that. Colleague Robert Perrin and I wrote about the Republican ideas in the newspaper this morning, and you should see the hate mail that's coming in from Democratic-leaning readers.
Well,
don't even want to read about those ideas. Yeah.
Well, you know, the question of where the GOP is on having a sort of theoretical health care reform bill of its own is really sort of all over the map. Here's Lamar Alexander on the floor last month responding to a rhetorical question he sort of assumes Democrats are asking, which is, what are Republicans waiting for here? Listen.
They'll be waiting a long time for the answer to that. If they're waiting for the Republican leader, Senator McConnell, to roll into the Senate a wheelbarrow filled with a 2,700-page Republican comprehensive health care bill.
Now, David Hertzenhorn of The New York Times, it seems as though Lamar Alexander is suggesting there that there is no policy behind the GOP, that it's really just a tactic. Do you agree with that?
Well, they've taken a careful approach here, right? The Democrats are in the majority. The Democrats set the agenda, and their point, the Republican leader Mitch McConnell as well, has said, look, we don't want to do a big, comprehensive, you know, system-wide overhaul. They want to go more of a step-by-step approach. Now, there are experts who will say that that won't get you where you need to go. That won't control health care costs. It won't cover the tens of millions of people who are uninsured. On the other hand, there's a lot of apprehension, as we've seen in polls, among Americans about so much change so fast.
And it does seem as though Congress is willing to, you know, where you need to go is simply get some doable bill out of the House and Senate. If they do something that is, in theory, doable here, what are we likely to see? What is doable? What sort of compromise could actually produce some kind of health care change?
Well, you know, the two sides certainly agree on some small things, like extending dependent coverage for adult children who get out of college. They're not in the job market necessarily yet, or in a job market where they have benefits. So, you know, allowing adult children to stay on their parents' policies till age 25 or 26 is something both sides agree on. In theory, they both agree on trying to figure out a way to stop insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. The Republicans, however, are finding it hard to get that into a limited proposal. Obviously, if you want to cover everybody, you need to have healthy people in the risk pool along with sick people, or it's just not affordable. So, you know, there are bits and pieces where they agree in theory of selling insurance across state lines, something that Republicans have long called for. The Democrats say they want to do the same thing. The question is, do you tighten federal regulation so that insurance companies just don't pick the state with the weakest regulations to be the one where they write their policies with the minimum levels of coverage? So that, you know, they're even on in areas where they agree, like something like, you know, selling insurance across state lines, they go about it in very different ways.
David Hertzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, talking about new tactics and that new approach to health care reform by the Obama administration, going public, convening a summit, and trying to talk about where the common ground is with the cameras rolling. Thank you, David.
Speaking of health care, here's a new approach to health care. How about we reduce health care costs by getting people to reduce their weight? The First Lady is taking on childhood obesity, and we want to open it up to you. If you've lost weight, do you have any tips for everyone else?
This is Laurie from Nashville. I'm a visual person, so what helps me is to make a chart, and I will write down what I've eaten for the day. And at the end of the day, sometimes I'm surprised because I didn't even know that that's what I was putting in my mouth.
Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we talk about work on Tuesday and today.
Grab a cup of coffee and squint across the table. Oh, my God, it's the Corporate Clark Gable. Office Romance, makes the day go faster. Office Romance.
In case you didn't know, Valentine's Day is coming, and we're wondering about office romances. Can they make you work better? We're going to talk more about it later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Iran has announced it's enhancing and expanding its nuclear program. The United States and France responded, saying there's no alternative now but strong new international sanctions against Iran. And the U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says Iran has rejected Western overtures and a collective international will is needed to find a peaceful way to resolve the issue. We're joined earlier by the BBC's John Lyon. He's our reporter in the field on Iran, and he filled us in on the latest from that country.
Well, they're stepping up enrichment from the level which you need to make fuel for a normal nuclear plant, 3.5 to 5%, which you can't use to make weapons, up to 20%, which you still can't use to make weapons, but it gets closer and it's much quicker. If you had a 5% uranium in a stockpile, which Iran does, it would take a couple of years to turn that into weapons grade. That is, with all the ifs and buts, and you kick out all the inspectors and you create that fast. But in theory, in a couple of years, they could produce a bomb.
So what
now,
is it?
If they then have a stockpile of 20%, they could then, from that material, make a bomb in maybe as little as 6 months. So it makes it a very dangerous situation.
So what does Iran say that their purpose is?
Well, they're talking about providing fuel for a Tehran research reactor, which they say produces much-needed medical isotopes. I think the rest of the world is pretty sceptical and really thinks this is more of a bluster, really, because most experts think it would be very difficult for Iran, although it may be able to produce the 20% fuel, it won't be able to turn it into workable fuel rods, which would actually be useful in that plant.
Hey, this is the Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking from France.
The key is persuading the Iranian leaders that their long-term best interests are best served by not having nuclear weapons.
How does one do that? How does one convince the Iranian government that they are best served by not having nuclear technology?
Well, the point is to convince them that to have a program, I think, that is clearly civilian and has enough guarantees, because the outside world insists that they don't have a problem with Iran having civilian technology, but they want more guarantees. The problem at the moment is that the Iranian government is not very susceptible to outside pressure. The real pressure on President Ahmadinejad is coming domestically from the opposition, who are going out in the streets again on Thursday, particularly from hardliners in his inner circle. So if he gives any sign of compromise, he just gets more trouble. So at the moment, it's really not worth his while compromising, even if he faces tough new sanctions.
Well, what kind of tough new sanctions would he be facing? What else do they have to threaten him with?
Well, there's some proposals going around the United Nations, particularly some interesting financial sanctions, including sanctions on the Iranian Central Bank, which, if they'd gotten through the UN, could be quite tough, but they got the problem of convincing China, and that is a big problem at the moment.
Who could veto any sanctions that they want to put forward, any at all?
That's right. They could veto or they could water the sanctions down to make them almost meaningless.
That's John Lyon. He was the BBC's Iran reporter. He joined us earlier from London.
All this morning, we're following the First Lady's fight, which she inaugurated today, against childhood obesity. But as anyone who's ever gone on a diet has told you, it's harder than it sounds. I mean, it seems like there are so many cultural messages about weight loss, it would be impossible for kids to miss. But we want to make it personal, not just for kids, for everyone. What's the reason that you've lost weight, and what's a tip that actually has worked for you? David in Southfield, Michigan emails us, turn down the thermostat, save money, help the environment, burn extra calories without thinking about it. I wonder if he has any data on that method. Tell us your stories, tips, and diet sins at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it all to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, are you attracted to someone at work? Maybe you want to go out for a date. You're thinking about it, but you're afraid there may be negative repercussions. Well, the good news is that actually there aren't a huge number of companies that forbid dating on the job. And also, dating somebody at your workplace can actually make you more productive. We're going to talk about this in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. First Lady Michelle Obama is launching Let's Move, a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. This morning, she told ABC what she envisions for young Americans.
They're enjoying their food, they're eating their vegetables, they're doing their running and walking and playing, and still, you know, have time to get a good fun meal in every once in a while. That's the life that, you know, I'm hoping that we can build for Americans.
To do that, the First Lady wants healthier foods, also more physical activity for kids, and better food labeling. So we've been talking about this all morning, and we want your take on this. If you've lost weight, what is the tip you have for everybody else? And part of the reason people have trouble losing weight is because their particular vices, maybe it's chocolate. We want to know what yours is. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. Democratic Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania is being remembered on Capitol Hill today for being a leading veteran advocate. Yesterday, Murtha died of complications from gallbladder surgery. He was 77.
We've been reporting all morning that Toyota is recalling more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide to fix widely reported brake problems. But could the latest recall get even bigger? We're joined now by Paul Eisenstein, a reporter for the DetroitBureau.com. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, John.
So it seems that, you know, we've kind of opened a can of worms here, and all of a sudden there are a lot of reports emerging. I'm wondering if you're seeing a broader pattern than just the 2010 Toyota hybrids.
Yeah, the DetroitBureau.com is reporting that there's a significant number of complaints, both with National Highway Traffic Safety Administration investigators, and we have been receiving a flood of complaints that date back as far as the 2005 Prius that indicate that there are various braking problems, alleged braking problems, we'll say right now, but some of them clearly match the problems on the 2010 models, the only ones that Toyota plans to recall at this moment.
How do you determine a real engineering problem from something that's basically a result of all the media attention where somebody goes, hey, you know what? My car was doing this weird thing. I'll call the 800 number. You know what I mean?
That's a very, very serious issue, and that's one of the reasons why we were particularly interested when we started getting problems about emails about problems with the Prius before all the latest headlines where Toyota has acknowledged and now plans to repair a braking issue with the 2010. But this ultimately will be up to Toyota and federal investigators here and Japanese investigators. But we do believe, based on our evidence, both in government files and what we're hearing directly, that a further investigation is necessary, and if it proves that there are problems, we could see this recall expand beyond the 2010 model year.
Well, we'll keep watching, and we will stay in touch with Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com. This just breaking in the Associated Press. After days of speculation, U.S. and Afghan soldiers have launched that operation to tighten Taliban-controlled town of Marja in Helmand province. The initiative has actually begun. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
A lot of people, when they start their jobs, they get a great big employee handbook. John, did you read the employee handbook, the whole thing?
Oh, sure I did. Yes, every single word.
You probably didn't.
But
you may not know that there's a national organization, actually, for human resource workers. Did you know this? They actually conduct what's called a romance survey.
Hmm.
And in the last romance survey, 72% of employers say they do not have a written policy about dating in the office. 14% say they have an unspoken policy that everyone just kind of understands. And here's maybe an even more surprising fact. Most HR managers say marriage is the most common end result of workplace romances. And they even say that studies show a higher level of productivity from dating couples on the job. So every time we want to talk about work, we, of course, talk to Beth Kobliner, our work contributor. She's here to explain all of this and some of the difficulties, challenges, and maybe benefits of dating on the work.
We're also going to date our way out of this recession. Is that what you're saying, productivity-wise?
I doubt it, but it's an idea. We're also joined by a happily married couple who met at work, Shelley and Kevin Shanoy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Beth, let's look at this historically, because in the 1990s, we saw some kind of draconian policies. Dating at work was really frowned on.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you talk about, you know, when you match it up with the recession. It's the first time we've gotten some heartening news, and a Vault.com informal study just is coming out tomorrow that showed that when you look at the recession, 70% of people say that despite bad economic times, it hasn't affected their willingness to take a risk and plunge into love in the workplace. So I guess that's the heartening news, that despite bad times, people are still willing to take a risk. But you're right. You know, the last few years, we have seen a growing acceptance of work in love in the workplace. In fact, if you look at people today in their 20s, about 30% say they have had a romance in the workplace. Where if you look at people today in their 40s and you ask, have you ever had a romance in the workplace? Only 17% say they ever have had that. So I think there's a shifting, you know, acceptance of what's okay. And most polls these days say 40 to 60% say of people say, yes, I've had some sort of romantic relationship in my workplace. And 30% claim that that has led to some sort of partnership or marriage.
Okay, well, that's a lot of numbers, but yeah. We have in us the actual real result of these numbers. Shelley and Kevin,
all
you guys...
numbers.
That's right. You guys met on the job.
Yes.
And you're working for an international banking corporation. How did this kind of get started? Were you actually dating while you were working together?
No, I was dating someone else I was working with at the same job. And you were dating someone else, sort of.
Yeah, I think...
I've got to get into this international banking thing.
We also were working in a very old group, so we were like some of the only like young people that we had met. So it was kind of cool to meet someone of our age bracket.
True, but I was actually dating someone on my team, which was seriously frowned upon. So that was like this big secret.
But you and Kevin were in different departments.
But then we were sort of in the related departments, I guess. But we were openly flirting at work because I was already hiding a different relationship.
Well, was there a negative reaction if you were openly flirting where people notice it? There was.
I think for her, we were discussing this before, and for me, I got like a little, you know, my coworkers would give me
memo.
A time.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like a reality show.
Yeah. So it was kind of more acceptable for you to be flirting Kevin than for Shelley.
Yeah, I straight up got pulled aside and reprimanded.
And it's interesting because there was a study that came out last year that showed that it can be especially damaging for women. It's unfair but true. Women tend to be judged more harshly in these kind of situations. And it seems that, you know, when you – on the outward, it sounds like a great thing. You meet somebody in the workplace. But there are a lot of pitfalls that people have to be careful of.
How do you avoid them? What's the best way to handle this?
Well, first of all, the big no-no – and these guys did it and they seem to be okay – but dating somebody who is your boss or your, in this case, he wasn't your boss, but somebody who, if you're an employee, for example, the U.S. Army bans outright the idea of dating a superior.
Right.
UPS bans outright. If you're an employee, an hourly employee, you shouldn't be dating a supervisor.
Because of harassment cases.
Absolutely. But other workplaces, they have these love contracts or, you know, various rules. So you want to know your company's rules.
Then there's Letterman.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And then you get into the situation of other workers being upset that, he's dating her and she's getting preferential treatment with the Letterman case. She's going on the air more. So are people upset that that person's getting... So they're all kind of state laws, federal laws, and workplace laws.
You should probably read your handbook, right?
Read that
handbook. Shelley and Kevin, what advice do you give to somebody who's met somebody on the job that they want to go out with, but they don't want to quit their job in order to date that person?
Be ready to keep a lot of secrets.
Be discreet.
you gotta be discreet. Don't be an idiot. I mean, don't flaunt anything. Don't make anything obvious. You've gotta try to hide it.
You're not saying don't be an idiot like I was. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I didn't want to say that.
That's the takeaway. Right. Don't be an idiot, which actually works on a lot of subjects
sweet.
On this
Have
show.
Happy Valentine's
Thank you
Day,
very
guys.
Shelley and Kevin Chenoy, a married couple. They met at work at an international banking firm. And, of course, Takeaway Work contributor Beth Koblenzer. Thanks so much.
You can learn more about Shelley and Kevin's intriguing romance on our website. We've got both versions of the story. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org. And do you have your own story of a workplace romance that went right or horribly wrong? We'd love to hear it in time for Valentine's Day, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or on our site, thetakeaway.org. And we want you to join the First Lady's Childhood Obesity Initiative, which she announced this morning. If you've lost weight, do you have a tip for the rest of us? What's the one thing you really can't give up?
My name is Jackie. I'm calling from Canton, Michigan, and I do a pretty good job of eating healthy, but my vice is Better Made barbecue potato chips.
Oh, my God. That's my vice, too. Yeah, Better Made. I feel you, Jackie.
We got a support group right here at The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
Put down the chips, Celeste.
I wish Hockenberry. I had some this Better Made potato chips.
Iran and the American presidency.
We will seek to continue, along with other nations and with the officials of Iran, a prompt resolution of the crisis without any loss of life and through peaceful and diplomatic means.
Historians believe that Jimmy Carter's presidency was brought down by Iran and the hostage crisis, and Iranian leaders have bedeviled White Houses of both parties ever since. Up until now, in the background during this administration, what are the emerging themes out of Iran so far for Barack Obama? Being held hostage by Iran, an old story with some new twists. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 9th, and The Takeaway on Iran is this a gathering storm for the Obama administration or an isolated cloud off in the distance?
You know, the hostage crisis, I was 8 or 9 years old. So Iran's been in the headlines my entire life.
Well, that's the speech Jimmy Carter announcing the failed rescue attempt.
Yeah, let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. We're getting word in the past few minutes, U.S. and Afghan troops have started what they say will be a major assault on the Taliban in Afghanistan. After British gunships cleared the area surrounding the Taliban-controlled city of Marja over the weekend, NATO soldiers are now moving in. About 400 U.S. troops, as well as 250 Afghan soldiers and their 30 Canadian trainers are now taking positions in the northeast part of the city. In other news, the wave of recalls continues to engulf Toyota. This morning, the company officially recalled 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids sold here in the U.S. last year. In all, 400,000 cars were recalled worldwide in this latest recall. Here's Toyota's president, Akio Toyota.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
If you're keeping score, that makes nearly 9 million cars and trucks recalled by Toyota in recent weeks.
Tributes are being paid this morning to John Murtha, the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in Congress. He died yesterday following complications from gallbladder surgery. Murtha was 77 and wielded considerable clout for two decades as the ranking Democrat on the committee which oversees Pentagon spending. The Pennsylvania congressman was also opposed to the war in Iraq.
Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America.
By going public and stating that back in 2006, Murtha changed the course of the war. He spent 36 years in Congress.
This morning, Iran says it's begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%. That's far short of the 90% needed for nuclear weapons. It still increases fears, though, that Iran is edging closer to producing a bomb. In response, the U.S. says it wants the United Nations Security Council to approve a resolution in weeks, not months, that would impose new sanctions against Iran.
We're going to discuss the nuclear issues between the U.S. and Iran in depth in just a moment. But first, Hamid Debashi joins us, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. Professor, would you say in this stage that there's more equilibrium or instability in the U.S.-Iran relationship?
Certainly instability. But the fact that overshadows that is that both President Obama and Mr. Ahmadinejad need each other. President Obama to get out of the mess that he inherited from President Bush, and Mr. Ahmadinejad to distract attention from his domestic problems.
Well, is that mutual need an opportunity? We're going to be back with you to talk more about Iran in just a moment, Professor Debashi.
This morning, First Lady Michelle Obama launched a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity, encouraging more physical activity for children and healthier foods in schools.
And that's our takeaway question this morning. Let's check markets quickly. Asian markets mixed. European indices up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 9,908, the first time it's opened under 10,000 since November. And the S&P opens at 1,056. The Nasdaq, 2,126.
We're going to go to Vancouver for a preview of the Winter Olympics. But back to our takeaway question. We're asking you for your tips on how you can lose weight and eat healthy foods. Give us your tips or your personal vices, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. In a few minutes, the latest on Iran and the country's plan to step up their nuclear program.
Good morning, everyone. You know, in thinking about Iran this morning, I came across this 1975 clip from 60 Minutes. It's Mike Wallace interviewing the Shah of Iran. Listen to this.
No, because their disarray, I think, needs a restructure of their society.
The brown-eyed peoples are teaching the blue-eyed peoples something.
Well, no, we are not teaching something. The blue-eyed people have to wake up.
The blue-eyed people have to wake up. Mike Wallace asked the Shah of Iran if he was happy of the disarray because of the energy crisis back in the 1970s, and that was his answer. Iran has been a theme of U.S. Middle Eastern politics for more than a generation, and it continues today. This morning, there are more signs of Iran in the news. The nuclear program, Iran says it's begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, far short of the 90% needed for nuclear weapons, but it still increases fears that Iran is edging closer to actually producing a bomb. We're rejoined now to talk about what are the themes during the Obama administration in U.S.-Iranian relations by Hamid Debashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia, and Houman Majd, journalist and author of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran. Good morning once again to both of you.
Good morning, John.
So, Houman Majd, let's talk with you first. Where would you say U.S.-Iranian relations are right now? Hamid Debashi said at the top of the hour that Ahmadinejad and President Obama need each other for reasons that are relatively unprecedented in U.S.-Iranian relations. But do you feel as though this relationship is stable or unstable right now?
Well, I would certainly agree with Professor Debashi that it is incredibly unstable, actually. It's quite ironic that a year into President Obama's presidency, after 8 years of George Bush, that we're at this stage right now. Everyone expected, obviously, relations to be at a more stable place than they are today. But, of course, the election of 2009 in Iran has caused a little bit of a hiccup in all of that, of course. But regardless, in terms of purely the nuclear issue, certainly it's very, very unstable. And I'm not sure it's entirely the Iranians' fault at this point.
Well, why don't you elaborate on that? Whose fault would it be?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think there are many, many factors involved in the nuclear issue, but I think that President Obama, who had promised negotiations with Iran and went through with the promise, certainly in October, has since October not really engaged Iran at all, other than essentially telling Iran to either accept the deal that was made in October, the offer that was made in October, or else. Iran has, in fact, a few times offered to negotiate further the deal that they rejected in October.
All right, and that's the offer to have a bilateral actual dialogue with Iran, which might be a prelude to something much more like we had under the Shah, which was actual diplomatic relations, embassies, that sort of thing. Hamid Debashi,
that's a long, long way.
Of course it is. Of course, absolutely. We don't want to go down that road. But Hamid Debashi, react to what Houman Majd was saying there.
No, I agree with Houman Majd that the relationship is in a standstill, but what he also knows is that since June we have had a massive civil rights movement in Iran, and millions of Iranians don't believe Ahmadinejad's government to be a legitimate government. And as a result, President Obama does not have a partner to talk to that the majority of Iranians accept. And as a result, what Ahmadinejad is doing is trying to bring the global attention away from domestic woes of his inside Iran towards either the geopolitics of the region or the nuclear issue. And as a result, every day we have contradictory news from his government. One day he accepts to shift the enrichment outside Iran. The other day, no, he's enriching inside Iran, which is his best bet. Not only just his government, but the entire fate of the Islamic Republic is now contingent on taking the world attention away, especially over the next few days. We have the anniversary of the revolution 31 years ago, and there are plans for massive, massive demonstrations against his illegitimate government, and as a result, this is yet another trick from his bag of tricks.
And we should stipulate that while the government in Iran is not popular, but the nuclear issue actually is something that can move the needle in polling and in sort of a popular support of a government policy. Hamid Debashi, when you see the White House and industrialized nations sort of playing something of a waiting game, thinking that the instability of the Iranian government may eventually overtake Ahmadinejad, do you think back in history to times when, you know, at certain points of instability, covert operations took down the government? Do you think that the U.S. has levers that it can pull, hoping that the instability of Iran reaches some threshold where we might trigger events inside the country?
Well, there are certainly forces within the U.S. Congress that have stipulated severe economic sanctions, covert operations, and even military strikes.
But I don't believe that any one of them will have any benefit to for this particular result. Yes, the Ahmadinejad government is very, very stable, but also the fact is that the Islamic Republic is entrenched within three layers of militarized security apparatus and is not hasn't anywhere to go. Ayatollah Khamenei is not the Shah. He doesn't have any Swiss chalet, or if he does, right, he's not in the way of traveling there.
Hamid Debashi is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. We're also talking with Houman Majd, who's a journalist and author of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran. We heard that exchange between Mike Wallace and the Shah of Iran, where the Shah of Iran said the message from the brown-eyed people to the blue-eyed people is wake up. If Ahmadinejad was asked that same question today, Houman Majd, what do you think his answer would be?
Oh, I think you probably have the same answer as the Shah had. I think there's a certain arrogance there. There's no question. And by the way, I agree that the timing of this announcement of the 20% enriched uranium is definitely linked to the domestic issues in Iran. And Ahmadinejad certainly wants to divert attention away from his own domestic troubles. But I do think also that Iran is adamant that it will do as it pleases and will not be dictated to the West, by the West. And I think that is a relatively popular opinion inside Iran, amongst the people, regardless of the, which side you're on, whether you're on the Green Movement side or on the government side.
Very quickly to both of you, it's a yes or no. Hamid Debashi, is the Obama administration losing an opportunity in these months?
No.
All right. Houman Majd, what would you think? Is the Obama administration losing or taking advantage of an opportunity in Iran?
I think they are potentially losing an opportunity, potentially.
All right, Hamid Debashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, and Houman Majd, journalist and author of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Politics of Modern Iran, talking about the themes in U.S.-Iranian relations at this point in the Obama administration. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following.
U.S. and Afghan troops have started what they say will be a major assault on the Taliban in Afghanistan. NATO soldiers are now moving into the Taliban-controlled city of Marja. About 400 U.S. troops as well as 250 Afghan soldiers are taking positions in the northeastern part of the city. Back at home, another blow for Toyota today. The company is recalling 130,000 vehicles in the United States because of a brake problem. That's part of a worldwide recall of more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid models.
So let's move, Celeste. First Lady Michelle Obama is launching a campaign with that title to fight childhood obesity today. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Joe Thompson, the Surgeon General in Arkansas, has one of the highest obesity rates in the nation, and he told us what his state is doing to combat the problem.
Trying to improve the cafeteria offerings in the school, trying to increase the level of activities both within the school and changing the environment around the school so that kids can walk and bike again. And we're raising awareness.
The First Lady says her focus is to help children avoid preventable illnesses caused by early obesity. Tributes are being paid to Pennsylvania Congressman John Murtha, who's died at 77 of complications from gallbladder surgery. He fought in the Vietnam War and later became a leading advocate for veterans on Capitol Hill. Weather news now, another winter storm headed for the Mid-Atlantic region, and Washington, D.C. could get another foot. That's at the area as the area digs out from the blizzard over the weekend. And for fans in New Orleans, the Super Bowl official victory party will continue today when the Saints are honored with a parade this afternoon. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Coming up, the Dow dipped below 10,000. What does it mean?
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on news stories we're following this morning. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped below 10,000 yesterday. It hit that magic number last November. It stayed there, floated above there for a few months, and yesterday fell below. We're joined now by Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. So what is it about 10,000 that makes it the magic number, Louise?
Well, 10,000 stood out during the tech bubble, you know, the big stock market run-up in the 90s, as the goal. And right, it had never passed 10,000. And when it did pass 10,000, in 1999, there was champagne on the stock exchange floor, and it was a really big deal. And that has forever minted that number in investors' minds as the thing to be above. And actually, since then, we've passed it 57 times. We've really wavered around. Before the financial crisis, we hit the peak of 14,000 in October of 2007. And if you talk with anyone who's a stock investor, which, you know, a lot of people have their retirement savings there, they will tell you that despite the run-up from the last year, getting back above 10,000, it still feels pretty bad to be this low below 14,000 where we were in October 2007. So some of the things that are worrying people are the crisis in Europe, the concerns about sovereign debt, Greece, Spain, Portugal, and also the sustainability of this recovery that looks like we're having but is very tentative, and also the fact that the Fed is going to have to start pulling liquidity out of the system. And so people are really worried that we don't really belong above 10,000 now with the state of the American economy.
Yeah, lots of people were saying that the 14,000 mark was unsustainable anyway. And how good of an economic indicator is the stock market anyway?
Well, you know, it certainly indicates people's expectations of economic growth and corporate earnings.
Okay. Louise Story is a business and finance reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Louise.
There's also computers that trade on the 10,000 number, right? I mean, it's like...
Yeah,
it's interesting. So it's robots as well. So our next takeout is really in the form of a question. What's the value of your own sense of home? This feeling of being in a place that's safe and yours, and a place that's not going away. It's hard to find a number for something like that. 10,000 doesn't really cut it. But Takeaway correspondent Farai Chidea found someone who has had to make that calculation. In our series, The Value, we hear stories of how harsh economic times have refocused the idea of what has actual value. Today, Farai brings us the story of a woman in Miami who found the values of home in a pretty unlikely place. Good morning, Farai. Tell us about Sierra Jones.
Now, I had this chance to visit an incredible 22-year-old woman named Sierra Jones, and she's already gone from being pregnant and homeless to having her own apartment and running a store. She is very clear about what kind of life she wants to lead, but she has had a hard time getting there.
I came up in a not-so-good environment where there was a lot of drugs and alcohol and abuse, and that's something that I would learn from and try my best. You know, I can't predict the future, but it's nothing that I'm interested in, and it's nothing that I want my daughters to have to grow up around.
You know, she is a mom now, this 22-year-old, and really in part, but only in part, this story is about how raising kids refocuses your idea of the value of home.
Absolutely. And she has had a very rough road in terms of family. She's someone who told me exactly how abruptly it was that her life changed.
I was actually in my first year of college in Tallahassee, Florida, on a scholarship, model student, and I ended up pregnant. So I decided to come back home and stay with my mom and try to do school here. It was never really a good situation at my mom's home ever since I was younger. So eventually it led to them giving me a day to find somewhere to live.
So she's given a day to find somewhere to live. And here, you know, you might think that because she was a model student and was on a scholarship that everything unraveling shows that she doesn't really understand the value of these opportunities. But in fact, it was just the reverse. Once she started to look on her own for a living situation, she found the values that we all take for granted.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's worth pointing out is that she was just embarrassed. She was embarrassed to be pregnant and a student. She wasn't failing. But, you know, instead of falling completely out of the world, she got this place, Lotus House. She found...
It's a shelter.
It's a shelter.
Right.
A really great shelter in Miami. She found a place there, had her baby while she was there. Now she manages the thrift store for the shelter, and, you know, she's raising her daughter, Chastity. She told me about the shelter, Lotus House.
I just thought to myself, this is a shelter. This is better than my mom's house. I just thought, well, how nice for it to be a shelter. And I opened the fridge, and there's food in the fridge. There's cheese and yogurt and everything you need when you're pregnant to nourish the baby, and new sheets. And I'm just thinking, I never had this stuff at my mom's house.
She gives you an indication of, you know, how far she's come.
Absolutely. And now she has her own apartment. She's pregnant with her second child. She wants to open an office and computer center in the Overland area of Miami. It doesn't have a lot of jobs or services. She wants to hire women from Lotus House to help run it, and she's really happy being a mom.
Now, do you think she can make it work? I mean, we hear a lot of dreamy stories of people that have all the sort of spirit that you can imagine, but it's a daunting economy right now.
Well, you know, everyone at the Lotus House has to work, and her job was to be the personal assistant to the woman who runs the organization. Mm. So she has had her own unofficial MBA. This is a woman who knows business.
She's got a mentor.
I believe in her.
Yeah. And she could find her way back to college.
Yeah, she could find her way back to college, or like people like Bill Gates, she could just go without a degree and make her way.
Farhad Chidea, ambitions very, very high there, but a great, great story. As always, our series, The Value, is online, and you can see video of Ciara Jones and the Lotus House at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Farai.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, we're going to find out what happened to the 33 Haitian children that were involved in that alleged child trafficking case that involved a Baptist group. More on that in a few minutes. But we're also following the First Lady's fight against childhood obesity. Her campaign begins today. But if you've ever been on a diet, you know that it's difficult. It's really hard to eat well, exercise, and lose weight. So we want to get your personal tips. Not just for your kids, but for adults, too. What are the tips that you have? And if there's one particular thing that keeps you from losing weight, for me, it would be barbecue potato chips. That's my vice. What is yours? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website.
Not eating.
TheTakeaway.org. Not eating?
Not eating. That works for me.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, you've heard all about the story of the Baptist group from the United States that is accused of kidnapping children from Haiti. But what happened to those 33 kids? We're going to find out in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. U.S. and Afghan troops have started what they say will be a major assault on the Taliban in Afghanistan after British gunships cleared the area surrounding the Taliban-controlled city of Marja over the weekend. NATO soldiers are now moving in. About 400 U.S. troops, as well as 250 Afghan soldiers and their 30 Canadian trainers, are now taking positions in the northeast part of the city. No reports of casualties yet, but witnesses say large plumes of smoke can be seen in the city. Toyota's fall continues. This morning, the company officially recalled 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids that were sold here in the U.S. last year. Here's Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
In all, 400,000 cars were recalled worldwide.
Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that private medical evacuations of children to the U.S. from earthquake-devastated Haiti have largely stopped. That's because aid workers and doctors are worried about being accused of kidnapping if they don't get the necessary paperwork, which is often slow to arrive or unavailable. More about that story in just a moment. The White House says it will spend nearly $80 million to help keep the giant Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. That money will go for sonar, electric shocks, and netting. The carp, a hungry, huge, non-native fish, threatens the ecosystem. Markets are open, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is making a stab at crossing above 10,000. It's about 99 points, which is right above 10,000, 10,015 at this point. Similar gains for the NASDAQ and the S&P. Futures trading suggested a positive opening. We'll see if it's sustained. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Good morning. For the past few weeks, we've been watching the developing story about the Baptist group from the U.S. who are accused of kidnapping 33 Haitian children. You may have wondered what happened to the kids themselves. Well, we have the answer for you. We've got Heather Paul. She's the CEO of SOS Children's Villages in the U.S. That organization was asked to take on the task of caring for these Haitian children and trying to find their relatives. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning, Celeste.
First, can you give me a status on these kids? Do you still have all 33 of them?
I believe we do, and it's very important that we conduct a full investigation as to why those children are there and the condition of their parents, what they knew when they gave those children into the hands of the missionary. So this is a proof positive why tracking, registration, and protecting those children is uppermost before we really determine their long-term future.
Have you found any of these kids, their parents or relatives?
Yes, parents and relatives have identified themselves, and that's all part of the investigation, again, as to whether these children are safe in their arms of their parents or extended family, and that's exactly what our investigations are about. We've been doing this in 130 countries for the last half century, so we know that these issues of children without parental care are very complex, and the motivations and the reasons why children are candidates for SOS Children's Villages or indeed final adoption need to be done very carefully.
Well, this kind of plays into what we've been hearing a lot lately, which is that there's no such thing as an orphan in Haiti. That's something that we've heard. Can you kind of explain what that means?
Well, I don't really think that's true. There are real orphans right now. We know that children have been, their parents have died in this terrible disaster, and perhaps extended family as well. Oftentimes in countries, there are what we call social orphans, where mothers and fathers and extended family are simply unfit and unwilling to take care of their children. And each situation really is quite different, so we can't have sweeping generalizations as to how many children should be adopted, how many are real orphans. We just right now are in the course of registration and protecting children in safe havens as much as we possibly can. We know that in the chaos of natural disaster, children are trafficked. They disappear. And I think this latest incident is proof positive on how important it is that we put children first, and we determine whether they are without parental care, and that we can get them to a safe place to determine their long-term outcomes.
Well, tell me about the condition of these kids. Are they basically healthy? Are any of them injured? Are any of them in need of special care?
Well, of those 33, we know that at least a third needed medical attention. We also have SOS staff from around the Caribbean who have come in who are psychiatric social workers. We know that many have been traumatized, some were dehydrated, and our job was to stabilize them. They're healthier now. Some are with their brothers and sisters, as you know. So, first and foremost, they are safe and they're well taken care of, and now we'll figure out the next steps and where their interests best lie.
Well, these 33 are just, you know, a portion of hundreds of kids that now need care in Haiti. How many kids do you normally care for in Haiti, and how many do you have now?
Well, we have two SOS villages in Haiti, one in Cap Haitien in the north, and then our one that's really almost at the epicenter of this earthquake and this situation, which is SOS Santo, about 12 kilometers outside Port-au-Prince. We normally take care of 200 orphan and abandoned children there and raise them and educate them. And now we have expectations that we're going to be taking care of 500. And so we're in the course of determining more long-term shelter, trained caregivers, and ways in which we can sustain them and educate them. So this is a long-term process. We're in this for the long haul, for years, years to come.
Well, the New York Times is reporting today that they've actually stopped evacuating children from Haiti because of this case with the Baptist group. People are afraid that they're going to be accused of kidnapping, which is having a chilling effect on airlifting kids out of Haiti. And I'm wondering, you call this a cautionary tale. What should we be learning from this case of the accused child trafficking and possibly kidnapping of Haitian children?
Well, that we do need proper documentation. Paperwork sometimes is perceived as something unnecessary and creating stalemates and delays. And we hope that that's not the situation. They certainly need to be identified before they leave the country. But I know that SOS is working in collaboration with all the NGOs, Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, World Vision, together with the Haitian government. So I hope in these collaborative sessions we can determine which children certainly are severely at risk and injured and need to get out of the country for much better medical assistance. So let's hope this stalemate is very short-lived.
Well, as you say, these 33 kids that you're taking care of are just part of the 500, I guess, you're going to have.
Right.
What if the kids say to you, you know, I was in a terrible situation at home? What if the parents say, I couldn't take care of my child?
I think it's a set of varying conditions. We know that some parents absolutely were devastated enough to want a better life for their children. We have to help them keep their children and sustain them by helping that family first.
Heather Paul is the CEO of SOS Children's Villages in the U.S. It's an international organization that helps orphaned and abandoned kids in about 130 countries, including Haiti.
First Lady Michelle Obama had the focus of U.S. kids and childhood obesity as part of her plan to create a new initiative to fight childhood obesity. And fat is definitely a foe to all ages in the United States.
Troy calling from North Dakota. I just came back from Haiti, and I was struck by how healthy and fit-looking Haitians are. I got in line for my flight home from Florida, and everyone looked fat and bloated, myself included, if I'm being honest. Some Haitians are, no doubt, malnourished, and I'm not making light of that, but we Americans definitely eat way too much.
Well, we're asking you to personalize the issue of obesity here in the United States, and it is relatively special to the United States. If you've lost weight, do you have any tips for the rest of us?
My advice is to keep your pie hole shut. Just don't eat when you're not hungry. And eat at mealtimes. That's it. It's not easy, but it works.
What's your story? What's your tip? 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. You have to use your pie hole.
Pie hole's a mouth, right?
If you call the phone, you have to use... Yeah, that is.
Yeah. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, it's believed there are about 200 detainees still at Guantanamo, the detention center that Barack Obama claims he will close but hasn't yet. Many have been released, and some go back to their home countries and are never heard from again. Some, we've reported on this program, have actually been implicated in terrorist incidents and organizing terrorism in places like Yemen. Some end up in court. But it's the rare ex-Guantanamo Bay detainee who ends up on stage.
Prisoner 661, 4 a.m., hand over your blanket.
They try to keep their hand clean, but they send me to Egypt for torture. I've been beaten, electric shock, every second.
That's the voice of Mamdou Habib, the former Guantanamo Bay detainee, performing part of his monologue. The show is called Waiting for Mamdou. It's a new play that opened today in Sydney, Australia. Phil Mercer, the BBC Sydney correspondent, joined us earlier this morning from Sydney. He's seen the play, and I asked him as a way of conveying to the world what went on in Guantanamo, how does this former detainee, Mamdou Habib, do?
Well, he does pretty well, given that he's not a trained actor, and he's trying really to express what he says are the awful conditions he endured after being arrested in Pakistan a month after the 9/11 attacks. He said he was sent to Egypt, where he endured, in his words, some horrific torture. He saw people murdered in front of his own eyes before being taken to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba in May of 2002. And Mamdou Habib's aim in all of this is really to show the Australian people exactly what happened to him and, in his opinion, what part the Australian government has played in what he's described as a global conspiracy to erode human rights.
And, of course, the themes that come up in this show are, of course, the treatment, the torture at the hands of international authorities. He was a victim of rendition. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's right. This play was co-written by Mamdou Habib, but also explores his wife Maha's troubled experiences in Australia. They claim they were raided several times by Australian security agencies. And since Mamdou Habib's release from Guantanamo Bay in the early part of 2005, he was repatriated to Australia. He is an Australian citizen. He was born in Egypt, moved here in 1980. And since his release, he claims that he's under constant surveillance by the Australian authorities. We've yet to hear from the Australian government about those allegations, but safe to say that these claims by Mamdou Habib have been enthralling audiences during opening night here in Sydney.
And certainly Mamdou Habib has had plenty to say about his adopted country, Australia. Listen.
The public in Australia, they very naive people. People doesn't believe what's going on. We talk about democracy, we were talking about the freedom, we talked about human rights. We don't have that. People have to know the truth.
Does this show by this former Guantanamo Bay detainee deliver truth, or is it more entertainment?
Well, it's not something you would necessarily take your children to see.
Right.
It is quite a gripping account. And what the producers say, they want to transport people in a very small way to Guantanamo Bay. And in terms of entertainment, well, it's probably more education, but certainly pretty hard-hitting.
We'll take that. It's a review from Phil Mercer, BBC Sydney correspondent. We talked to him earlier about the premiere of Waiting for Mamdou, a new monologue by an ex-Guantanamo Bay detainee now playing. Hard-hitting, says Phil Mercer in Sydney, Australia. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. It's not an athlete, but it will be on the Olympic stage when the Winter Olympics begin later on this month. Getting to know Vancouver and the mountains of Western British Columbia. coming up in just a moment. But we're also taking this morning out to talk about the First Lady's fight against childhood obesity, and we're asking for your stories. If you've lost weight, what is your story?
This is Laurie from Nashville. I'm a visual person, so what helps me is to make a chart, and I will write down what I've eaten for the day. And at the end of the day, sometimes I'm surprised because I didn't even know that that's what I was putting in my mouth.
Part of the reason it's hard for anyone to lose weight is because of vices, things that you just can't keep out of your mouth. What's yours? Don't be ashamed. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check of leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Iran says it's begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%. That's far short of weapons grade needed for nuclear weapons, but it still increases fears Iran is edging closer to producing an actual bomb. Yesterday, U.S. and France called for strong new sanctions on the country. In Afghanistan, U.S. and Afghan troops have started what they say will be a major assault on the Taliban in the country. Right now, NATO soldiers are moving into the Taliban-controlled city of Marja.
Toyota says it'll recall more than 130,000 Prius cars and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids in the U.S. They're part of a worldwide recall to fix brake problems. Company President Akio Toyoda says he'll revive Toyota.
Let me assure everyone that we will redouble our commitment to quality as a lifeline of our company, with myself taking the lead.
The latest recall is in addition to the company's earlier one for faulty gas pedals. That brings the recall total to nearly 9 million. First Lady Michelle Obama is starting a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity today. This morning she tells ABC News she likes a little junk food too sometimes.
I love burgers and fries, and I love ice cream and cake, and so do most kids. And we're not talking about a lifestyle that excludes all that. The question is, how do we help people balance that out?
The First Lady says she wants her daughters and the rest of America's children to learn more about better nutrition and exercise. Finally, a winter storm heading for the Mid-Atlantic region, and Washington, D.C. could get another foot of snow. That's some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Well, we'll be hearing a lot of that Olympics music as the Winter Olympics begin this month in Vancouver and up in the stunning mountains of western British Columbia. For many in the world, this geologically spectacular fusion of ocean and forest and mountain snows will be the star of the show until the medal contests among the athletes really get down to business. Vancouver is also a fascinating cultural center on the Pacific Rim, a mix of Western Canadian toughness and Asian sophistication. And with a portrait of this community about to absorb an onslaught of media, fans, and athletes, we're joined by Rebecca Bowett, who's the author of the Vancouver-based blog Ms. 604. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
And Ian Austin is the Canada correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. He also joins us from Vancouver. Ian, thanks for being with us.
Oh, no problem. Good morning.
So, Rebecca, what's the one thing you want people to know? I mean, I've been to Vancouver. It is one of the absolutely most beautiful, fascinating, fabulous places in the world. It's one of my favorite places of all time. But what do you think people should know about your community?
I think that it's just such a mix of kind of outdoors and city. And for a while, we've kind of been Toronto's little sister city in Canada, and we just want to build up that we are a world-class city. We have great resources here, and yeah, it is just a beautiful place, like you said. Thanks.
Ian Austin, it is visually spectacular, but what is the sort of cultural and economic significance of Vancouver as a Pacific Rim city?
Well, you know, as you mentioned before, it's obviously the Pacific Rim gateway. What the city, I think, is hoping from these games is to reposition itself. It wasn't that long ago that near the hotel where I'm now sitting was nothing but acres and acres and acres of sawmills. It's moved past that. It's a big film production center, video game center, sort of a knowledge city, and that's what it wants to redefine itself as.
And what do the bloggers say on Miss 604, Rebecca Bowett?
Well, people are really excited. Yeah, it is also emerging kind of as a tech hub. There's a huge blogging community, social media community. So a big thing about especially these games and the city in particular is there's a lot of citizen journalists out there. So everyone has their camera and their recorders for podcasts, and everyone's just writing up the storm about what's going on.
And is the onslaught of the Olympics something to be feared if you're a blogger, or something to embrace? And any bad guys and good guys shaken out in the discussion so far, Rebecca?
No good guys and bad guys yet. I think everyone's pretty open to just going out there, having a good time, creating content, and try not to have a camera where they're not supposed to.
Right, because the security will be a huge issue. Ian Austin, the weather has not really cooperated. At least I'm looking at the temperatures. I do know the melting point of water, and it's it hasn't broken freezing there in Vancouver much this winter. Is anyone worried?
Well, I mean, of course, the organizers are never worried when it comes to bad weather. It's a lovely spring time period right here in Vancouver itself. It's not an issue for the downhill skiing. That's about 2 hours away in Whistler, which has a record amount of snow. What it is an issue for are aerials and snowboarding. The resort where they're being held at the lower levels is very, very soggy, becoming very, very muddy. So they've been pushing and airlifting snow down from the top of the two mountains of that resort to the bottom where things like the half pipe are.
Rebecca Bowitt, is Whistler kind of like an Aspen of Canada, you know, a place where the rich go to play in the winter, or is it more of a working class ski resort?
It's a bit of both. It's got a great international community. We've got lots of people who come up from Australia and go there, and we have people who just take day trips up from Vancouver. But then you also have your condos and your resorts. But it is very accessible for anyone of any income.
What event does Whistler really favor? Is it the downhill? Is it the slalom? Is it the jumps?
The downhill is really huge. The bobsleigh run is also there, the sliding center. So I think a lot of the more of the outdoor and also the more wintry-looking activities will happen there since it's not quite happening on the North Shore.
All right, so Ian Austin, if you want to get away from anything cosmopolitan and avoid the sense of international community and get your straight dose of Canadian, straight ahead, you know, sort of my era Canadian, where do you go to hang out?
Where do you go to hang out in Vancouver? You should be asking the local blogger about that. I mean, you know, the city's showing its street cred by showing off its worst neighborhood, the downtown east side. You get a bit of Canadianism everywhere in the city. Certainly there's as many Tim Hortons outlets as Starbucks.
And Tim Hortons, of course, a coffee place that's very famous, just started here in the United States. Rebecca Bowitt, where do I go to have a moose head, hey?
To have a what? Sorry.
Yeah, see, what a jerk I am. I'm turning off our Canadian listeners in droves. Where do you hang out in the city? What's your favorite place?
In the city, there's so many different places. You can be right downtown in the downtown core, or you can head out to Commercial Drive. You can head out to South Main. Those would be some great areas, especially during the games, since they're not kind of in red zones.
That's right. Stay out of the red zones. Rebecca Bowitt is author of the Vancouver-based blog Miss 604, and Ian Austin is the Canada correspondent for the New York Times, who joins us from Vancouver, where the Olympics are coming, and as you heard, they're getting ready.
If you missed anything on the show, or maybe you want some bonuses, you can go to the website, thetakeaway.org. One of the bonuses, I posted a recipe. We were talking earlier about the First Lady's fight against obesity and how eggplant parmesan could be a good, healthy choice for kids. A lot of people on the website said, oh my God, the frying, the cheese, the breading. But so many people reacted, I posted a healthy recipe for eggplant parmesan, so you can still enjoy it without the guilt. That's at thetakeaway.org.
Eggplant parmesan last night for dinner. I have no guilt. Eating healthy isn't that easy, though, and you know it, because we've been asking people at 8778MYTAKE, even if you want to lose weight, what's the vice? What's the sort of food obsession that you just can't give up?
This is Heidi calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. I try to eat really healthy, watching my portions, but my vice is ice cream. That's one thing I can't give up, and I eat it at least a couple times a week.
And the Ice Cream Manufacturers Association is grateful for all of that. For those of you who've been successful putting down your vices or anything else, any tips for the rest of us?
My name is Mark from Detroit, Michigan. After my wife and I both downloaded calorie counter apps for our phones and realized that piece of toast has more than 100 calories, it wasn't too hard to cut down and lose some pounds.
This is Regina calling from Lake Orion, Michigan. People just need to be aware of what they're putting in their mouths. Read your labels. Make sure you can pronounce it. Make sure it's food and lots of filtered water.
This is Alex from Columbia, South Carolina, and I would just like to say that
it's time for the hottest party.
Playing Dance Dance Revolution helped me lose 30 pounds in one summer.
There you go. I like Alex. If you've lost weight, what's a tip you have for everyone? Dance Dance Revolution or anything else, 8778MYTAKE, or post your diet sins to our website, thetakeaway.org. And as always, we want your nominations for who in the news is having a good week and a bad week. Every Friday, we tally it up with our friends at The Week magazine. But let's get your nominations, too. Don't give them all the fun. Call us at 8778MYTAKE or post it to thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Revolution Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Better made barbecue potato chips. Highly recommended.
Look at him go.
Not by Michelle Obama.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.